Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here once again with one of these remotely recorded Truth in Movies specials. As I teased in our previous episode all about Minari, we're back with these episodes looking at some of the big Oscar contenders of the year. Today I'm joined by David Jenkins. David.
Hello.
Always a pleasure. I can't believe it's been almost a year since we were in the same room together.
Has it really been that long?
Yeah, we've had so many of these intimate conversations on mic. I was reminded last week by Hannah Woodhead that it's a year now since the Dad Pod.
Oh my God, the Dad Pod, that was an all-timer. I still get emails about that. Like, where's Dad Pod 2?
Well, exactly. Let's not go off topic too quickly though. No. We've got bigger fish to fry today. We're also joined by Layla Latif. Layla, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Again, almost a year since we were last on the podcast together.
Yeah, I both can't believe it and also it does feel like I've been sat in this exact room for a year now. So hopefully not too much longer. We'll mm-hmm. be in each other's presence again.
We'll have exactly. to record the next one in a pub beer garden or, you know, an al fresco dining experience or something like that.
Or maybe like the front row of a music festival or something. Yeah. As many people around us as we can get. But before we can really start with the new year and put 2020 to bed, we need to talk about some of the big films from 2020, which are still slowly coming out in cinemas, on streaming platforms in the UK during this sort of long protracted awards season in the run-up to a late Oscars. So today we're going to be dedicating the podcast to one of the sort of breakout stars, I'd say, of awards season this year, writer, director, editor Chloe Zhao with her film Nomadland, which is, I believe, on Disney Plus at the end of April. But to mark that occasion, MUBI have dug out her debut film, Songs My Brothers Taught Me, that's coming to MUBI on the 9th of April. So we're going to cover both of them, where she started and where she's ended up. Like that meme, right? How it started, how it's going. This is the podcast form of that. And also we can look ahead to maybe what she's doing next as well, because we know she's already shot the big Marvel movie, Eternals, that's due out at the end of 2021. And I think there was some ridiculous quote from a Marvel exec saying, "We just couldn't believe what we saw that she'd shot. It's going to burn your eyeballs out of your skull," or whatever they said, some sort of hyperbole like that.
Well, yeah, I saw the photo of Kumail Nanjiani post his kind of bulking up, and that did burn my eyeballs out of my skull, so achieved.
I know. The things that Chloe Zhao has given us. Anyway, let's kick off with Chloe Zhao's first film, Songs My Brothers Taught Me. So Songs My Brothers Taught Me, released in 2015, is a coming-of-age story set against the stark beauty of South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. The film focuses on teenager Johnny and his younger sister Jashawn, two Lakota Sioux siblings whose bond is tested after the sudden death of their absent cowboy father. With an older brother in jail and living with their distant single mother, the pair spend the days navigating the harsh terrain of their small town, where opportunity is scarce and poverty, alcoholism and violence is rife. When the chance of a new life in LA arises, Johnny is faced with the difficult choice of leaving Jashawn behind forever. Let's hear a clip from the trailer.
want to see what's out there. Go travel all over, see things.
My brother Johnny is moving away with his girlfriend. I don't understand why everyone's always leaving.
Did you hear about Dad?
Yeah.
If there was one thing that you could have said to him before he died, what would it had been?
Probably would have made him stay here instead of heading out.
Trying to do it on here, Johnny boy.
Johnny? I'll see you tomorrow. Johnny?
Just don't make God another man that you abandoned your children for.
I'm sorry. I love you so much.
I wish I grew up with you.
That was a clip from the trailer for Songs My Brothers Taught Me. So I guess a bit of basic background info on Chloe Zhao. She's born in Beijing, China, but studied over in the States. She studied at the prestigious Tisch School of the Arts in New York. She studied under Spike Lee. She lists among her influences Wong Kar-wai, Terrence Malick, Herzog, Ang Lee. Lots of big names being dropped here. So, David, this is her first film, and maybe going back now, having seen where she ends up with something like Nomadland and her film The Rider, her second one, she almost is arriving fully formed with this film in terms of her style, right?
Well, that's a somewhat leading question, Michael, but I would actually agree with you on that front. I didn't really know much about this one until... I knew it existed, and actually it had been sitting on YouTube for quite a long time, and obviously has been sort of taken down off there for so it can be kind of passed through official channels. So I think the opportunity to watch it has been there if for those who wanted to see it. It's a really impressive film. Like I think the thing that you get from her from this film is her sense of working with actors, working with non-actors, sculpting dialogue, building scenes out of kind of very little, just capturing like small nuances and very very kind of subtle emotions. And also it's got a kind of, I guess you'd sort of describe it as a sort of ethnographic feel as well, in that you're kind of looking at a community and you're kind of by showing the characters' lives, showing what they're doing. I mean, Johnny has this kind of sideline business of selling alcohol, like kind of bootlegged alcohol, because I think it's banned on their reservation. So there is this kind of like political undertow to the whole film, where you've got like a lot of the sort of deprivation and a lot of the squalor is actually the result of people basically kind of becoming alcoholics because it's been banned, because it is this kind of illicit, illegal thing that maybe brings a new allure to it. You definitely have that kind of, you know, it's a kind of political film without kind of sort of smushing your face in it. Maybe something else, you know, in a similar way to Nomadland, which we can maybe come to later. But yeah, no, it really is a kind of remarkably impressive debut in terms of the kind of the scope and the finesse of it. I mean, maybe the story where we kind of see this kind of character who faces all these dilemmas, and then by the end he has this chance for escape and he has to kind of choose between family, community and freedom and this potential for a new life. Maybe getting to that point maybe felt a little kind of simplistic and like conventional way to go, but I think there's so much kind of interesting nuance and texture and the performances are so kind of subtle that actually you'd be willing to give it a bit of leeway in terms of it not feeling too, it's not a hacky thing. It's it's done sort of in a quite nice, subtle way. But
yeah, what hit me so strongly about watching this film after seeing Nomadland, of course, maybe many listeners saw Chloe Zhao's second film, The Rider, which was a film that premiered at Cannes in director's fortnight and really sort of, for many people, was the entry point into her work. So much of her creative DNA is here. And it's that sense of marginalized communities, in this case, these communities living on the reservation. Nomadland moves away from that a little bit, perhaps. But also use of non-actors, the sense of these characters within a landscape that is beautiful and overwhelming, but can almost be agoraphobically overwhelming as well. So it's all playing in then in the sense of almost a docudrama feel as well, where what's playing out in before your eyes is so organic, but also there is this narrative, this plot, as you described, David. So all these key things are still there. Layla, how did Songs by Brothers Taught Me hit for you?
Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, I think like many people who listen to this, like it was Nomadland was my entry point, and then I've gone back to see her earlier work. I mean, the Terrence Malick influence is very obvious there, that kind of like beautiful American plains at twilight and like the soft sunlight through like long grass. It's absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, she's got a huge amount of empathy for all of her subjects. And I imagine like there's a lot of trust that they're putting into her too, because, you know, a lot of these people are tapping into, in all three films, into like really difficult moments in their lives and having to kind of recreate them and put them on again for the screen. I mean, I think particularly in The Rider that struck me, where you know, you've got a person, the subject of the film has had like this horrific accident, and he's also had a friend who's had a similar, even worse accident, and their recovery is just heartbreaking to watch. But, you know, this is also their real lives. They're not putting it on for the film. And imagine to sort of create an arc about yourself must be like very intense and difficult. But she manages to sort of, I don't know, I just feel like it's acting with a small A, like they are just sort of inhibiting their own lives, even though it is a recreation. It isn't exactly how events spilled out. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing, this kind of line between documentary and drama, isn't it?
It makes me think of, you know, Ken Loach, although with the political aspect maybe buried a couple of layers deeper rather than being so front and centre. But the idea of taking people who are very closely playing their lives, taking such an empathetic inspiration from the world around them. The thing that strikes me about her films is that sense that the landscapes she's often filming, which are beautiful, as you say, Layla, every film she's made has had an absolutely knockout few shots or scenes where you just can't imagine how she captured them. But they're landscapes we often associate with old films, 1940s, 50s, 60s westerns. It's not something we're so used to seeing on screen, particularly in the sort of independent American tradition. So there's an almost post-apocalyptic quality to them. Not to sort of cheapen the political edge, because it's almost as if America, as we know it from the sort of urban America, has moved on, and these communities have been left by the wayside. There's something quite haunting there about these films, particularly I feel with Songs Where Brothers Taught Me and Nomadland.
No, but I know what you mean about like forgotten people, right? Because that's this actually like a huge rhetoric that we've heard from like particularly like the right wing in America about like, oh, that, you know, people don't care about these like coastal elites, and within like these heartlands that there are these forgotten people. And like, for all that, you know, politicians might use that in a very disingenuous way. Like, I did feel that, like, there was something that they're tapping into there. Like, I truly believe that, like, these, like, communities and these reservations, all these kind of, I don't know how you describe them, these, like, geriatric nomad workers are just forgotten by society. And, it, like, the beauty of Chloe Zhao is, like, going in and sort of creating a poetry about their lives. That makes sense.
Well, yeah, it's a, we can get to this, I think, with Nomadland, and we can talk about this, about our responses to these films. Mm. I sometimes find that poetry often rubs up sometimes against the more literal aspect of turning this into a narrative, turning it into a plot. And Dave, you mentioned this about this film, so maybe we can talk a bit more about that specifically. But it is the great empathy that strikes for me. So Songs My Brothers Taught Me, we talk about this central brother-sister pairing at the heart of the plot. But one of the things that is revealed when they go to the funeral of their dad is that he had 20 odd kids to many various partners. And so throughout the rest of the film, these other siblings keep popping up, and it's their relationships with them where they clearly are bound by quite deep links by blood, but their relationships are quite, you know, minor or fleeting, but it's how they respond to each other. There's a beautiful scene where Johnny meets with one of his half brothers, and they share a jalapeno popper in a diner, and that brother has seen something, a restlessness, a conflict within Johnny, you know, from the off, and he wants to give him a hand. And it's so touching and moving in that moment, because there is at the heart of this film almost Bruce Springsteen lyric type, want to get out of this place, get to the big city kind of feeling. But David, you said that the plot stuff was where that was where it started to lose you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very minor, minor quibble, because I almost don't think that plot in the same way. I think pretty much in the same way as of The Rider and Nomadland, I don't think the kind of three act plot is very central to Chloe Zhao's concerns, really. I think she's really great at kind of developing a kind of emotional arc, I guess, like taking you to a place and watching a character develop. And I think that her films are more kind of character studies than they are, you know, narratives. Probably Songs My Brothers Taught Me has the sort of the softest narrative. So when you do have that kind of, you know, the dilemma aspect at the end, is less troubling, or it doesn't seem as egregious as it might do a film that had kind of placed all its chips on kind of leading you to that moment. But I mean, I think I want to come back to the point you said actually about this idea of, yeah, like the sort of apocalyptic aspect, and also Layla, what you mentioned about the forgotten people. I think that like her films certainly have they tap into this idea of like of tradition and people who are kind of, who have lived their lives in a certain way and maybe don't have the kind of inclination or desire to change them. They kind of, it's less of a case of being stuck in their ways and more wanting to sort of like more it being ingrained within them. And I think that this idea of like the lure of rodeo riding in both this and The Rider, as something, as a rite of passage, as something that as a man, as a hot-blooded male, you have to do to prove your worth, and as we see in The Rider, it often doesn't end very well. And you know, a lot of her films do remind me of, like, I think less of the kind of, you know, 40s westerns that are a bit more kind of like the sort of the John Fords and the Howard Hawkses and whatnot, and I think more of the kind of like slightly later 50s and 60s westerns that are a bit more laconic and like it's not really a western, but like that maybe like the kind of Sam Peckinpah films. And also there's one a Nicholas Ray film called The Lusty Men. I don't know if either of you have partaken, but it's I think I'd love one day to find out if Chloe Zhao has seen it. I'm sure she must have, because it is like probably the greatest rodeo riding film, and it is basically about this guy who just cannot give up rodeo riding, despite the fact that he's basically going to die if he does it again. Yeah. and he kind of like is able to sort of stick in that world by taking on a protege, and it's very and it's kind of like, yeah, in a similar way, it's very laconic, set against these kind of dusky backdrops, and you can see like that these men are in this world, like trapped in this very small world, as kind of progress is kind of happening around them, and people are kind of moving on from this kind of, you know, basically this very sort of machismo death sport world. So and yeah, it seems, I mean, not in Songs Songs of the Brothers Taught Me, not just a literal thing that he is doing that, but all the male characters in the film, I mean, the very idea that the father has, you know, numerous partners and numerous offspring from different women is, again, feeds into that. It almost feeds into a kind of biblical notion, you know, like something that's very kind of antiquated, like what now, but actually is, you know, a lot many would see as being part of a kind of a tradition. So I think that is the thing about her films that you see really vividly in this first film that I really like the most, I think.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
But there's also some key sort of conflicts and dichotomies that may sound trite, as I describe them now, but in the films come across as so profound. The conflict between these wide open plains but such narrow opportunities. The conflict between the hardness of masculinity but also a softness as well. There's within the rider, which we'll gloss over a little bit because these two films being shown in the UK for the first time, but the rider really is worth a look as well. He is a rodeo rider who's suffered an injury and can't do this, you know, can't perform again. However, there are sequences where he's starting to break horses and connect with horses, and beautifully sensitive sequences in the middle of the film where I would happily watch a 4-hour cut of just him making friends with a horse. This guy, Brady Jandro, who's sort of playing himself and his family are playing themselves, and nearly the entire cast of that are non-actors too. There are these moments within all these films of just sort of sensitivity, which are really worth reveling in.
I think it really speaks to what animals often do for people. That, you know, sometimes when you kind of cannot quite form, I mean, this is going to sound dismissive, but like you cannot quite form functional relationships with people of your own species, but like that you can actually just, the act of like caring for someone, even if they aren't a person, you know, be it like a horse or, you know, a small bird or whatever it is, it's just like the act of like having a simple relationship of care and affection is necessary for someone like that. But I really like the ideas in both The Rider and Songs My Brother Taught Me of like this kind of crisis of identity for the native population. So they're not a group of people that we've had a lot of modern portrayals of, and I mean I don't know, but my assumption is with Chloe Zhao that was a kind of hugely researched, and she really like immersed herself in that community. And recently there's been so much coming out about like the death rates with the virus uptake rates and all of the problems that they're having and those reservations, and kind of a portal into that world with all of its kind of problems, both smaller and large, was really very moving right now.
At the time, I didn't know. I'd witnessed something extraordinary.
My Octopus Teacher is an Academy Award and BAFTA nominee for Best Documentary.
When you have that connection with that animal, there's no greater feeling on Earth.
Variety magazine calls it gorgeous, an underwater spectacular.
The boundaries between her and I seem to dissolve, just the pure magnificence of her.
My Octopus Teacher, only on Netflix.
Before we wrap up on Songs My Brother's Taught Me, let's use The Rider as a bit of a bridge between these two films, because it was, for many, the first taste of Chloe Zhao. David, I remember we were in Cannes that year in the equivalent of Little White Lies flats that summer. I will say, I won't name them, but there is a colleague of ours who'd seen The Rider in advance and told me that I could easily skip it. Little did we know that it would become one of the most talked about films of the festival, and it was a real win for Directors Fortnight, that parallel selection, having it as one of their films. And then it just grew and grew all the way through to the sort of Independent Spirits at the end of that year. What was it like sitting down to watch The Rider?
Oh, I'm ashamed to say that I'm in a similar boat as you.
Oh, really?
I didn't see it in Cannes either. I must have taken the advice of the same person. But I mean, that's as people who listen to this podcast regularly will know, we do like to wang on about films that we missed in Cannes. So here's another one for the pile. But yeah, I actually didn't see it till I went to a press screening in London. So I still had the full on cinema experience, which is, you know, a nice thing to have. I was really impressed with the film. It's a weird thing. I think I've maybe got a little bit of a problem with when she's trying to do plot, or where she's trying to sort of like bring things to a head or create a kind of moment, really, really kind of engineer a drama. Whereas like, I totally agree with you. I think the sequences of him just breaking horses in the middle of the film are just kind of pure poetry, and like do so much heavy lifting in terms of what the film is about, and channel so much sort of sensitivity. And it's actually been like, I haven't actually seen it since it came out of the cinema. So I can't, the details are a bit hazy, but yeah, I mean, again, it kind of comes to a point where, a dilemma is on the table, and a choice needs to be made. And you kind of know which way things are going to go. But yeah, I think that this was I remember what one of the talking points around this film was, and one of the things that Chloe Zhao was kind of earmarked for early on was her, you know, the fact that, wow, this, she's made this film with non-professional actors. Mm. You know, it's people playing versions of themselves, and people kind of emulating their real life stories. And it's interesting because it was like, I think that I've reading about it, it was only ever praised. It was only ever thought of as a kind of, you know, this is a remarkable thing to do. You know, this is to kind of end in, I don't want to use the word infiltrate, but like, what's a softer word for infiltrate? It's like
embed yourself.
Embed, yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, she's kind of embedded herself in this community, and like the I think there are a fair few directors who, you know, who do that. Like one of my all-time faves is this Portuguese director called Pedro Costa, who he does a very similar thing in that he, you know, he will go and live in a community for months and months and months before he even picks up a camera, and he will basically kind of befriend the people who are going to be in his film and find out about their lives and try and make it about, you know, basically his aim is, I want this to be about you and I want it to feel authentic. So, and I can't do that if I don't know you. So it feels like Chloe Zhao is doing similar things in, you know, you kind of imagine in Hollywood, you'd get people like rocking up, you know, and being like, you know, it's almost like the kind of the very different example, but everything comes back to The Simpsons, but it's like the Radioactive Man film where they just kind of rock up in Springfield and wanting to cast the locals and it all goes wrong because you just can't do that, you know, even in a comedy cartoon. But like, you know, you get with everything she's done so far, including, you know, all three films, you get the sense that she's done the groundwork. You know, she's earned the right to tell those stories.
Yeah, authenticity seems to appear in pretty much everything that's been written about her. That like everything feels very real, very authentic, very researched, very lived in. But sorry, I kind of can't get on to my next point until we get to Nomadland. But once we get there, I will continue that thought.
I think it is worth moving on to Nomadland. Before we do, do we want to put scores on Songs My Brothers Taught Me? It's technically a new release to us, even though it's kind of a film club pick, an old film. So this would be in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect. And Layla, I'll come to you first.
Probably go with a 4 in anticipation. Enjoyment, it's probably a 3. It's probably my least favourite of the 3, even though I did have a lot to recommend it. And then in retrospect, I give it a 4 because I just think it's so remarkable that you kind of emerge so like fully formed with a vision of the filmmaker and a style and like this feels incredibly complex and like it has a real beauty and poetry and distinct Chloe Zhao-ness to it. So yeah, in retrospect, 4.
David?
I'd probably do exactly the same. Yeah, I mean, in anticipation, you know, obviously we have the kind of the gift of hindsight and her, you know, various awards and festival wins and everything. So wanting to see, you know, wanting to return to the scene of the crime is obviously a very intriguing prospect. Watching the film, I thought it was kind of remarkable on a kind of scene by scene basis. Whether it all kind of coalesced was less so. And then maybe pretending that we don't know about what she's about to do. If I was pretend whisking myself back to that time and pretending that the rider and Nomadland didn't exist, I probably would say I was would be very excited to see what she did next, because I mean the rider is very similar to it feels like the rider was a kind of almost not remake but like a kind of refit.
Same community, similar
sort of setting, similar main character.
I mean, we don't necessarily need to pick favourites. I mean, the great thing is that she's got such a small filmography. They're all about similar length, about an hour 40, an hour 50. So it's not like there's a huge draw on your time. So.
Well, The Rider is my favourite, even though I don't have to pick.
It is mine too. But, you know, if you have a movie subscription, I'd recommend checking out Songs My Brothers Taught Me, because that's my thing. If there's a filmmaker that's an exciting filmmaker who has a debut that was never released in the UK, I can't wait to get my hands on that. We had that recently with Dead Pigs for Kathy Yan. Mm-hmm. And it's great that maybe you've found this one as well. I hope for more to come. I'd love to see more Lee Isaac Chung movies after seeing Minari and talking about that last week. Well, so I'd probably give it 4.342, you know, but definitely check it out, I think.
They're, on that note, I think there is some Lee Isaac Chung early work on YouTube at the moment. So, you know, you can... I'm sure it'll be snapped off soon, and it'll be box setted before sundown.
Well, if he wins Best Picture, etc., I'm sure. So let's get on to the big events, the big new release, now bumped up from a Fox Searchlight release to a Searchlight release by Disney, of all people, premiering on the Disney Plus platform at the end of the month. Let's talk about Nomadland. Following the economic collapse of a company town in rural Nevada, Fern, played by Frances McDormand, packs her van and sets off on the road exploring a life outside of conventional society as a modern-day nomad. This third feature, from Chloe Zhao, features real nomads Linda May, Swanky and Bob Wells as Fern's mentors and comrades in her exploration through the vast landscape of the American West.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom says that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
No.
My husband worked at the USG mine in Empire. I was a substitute teacher.
It is a tough time right now. You may want to consider early retirement.
I need work. I like work.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Welcome to Badlands Spa.
What the nomads are doing is not that different than what the pioneers did.
Bigger.
I think Fern's part of an American tradition.
Oh, he's gonna come right through the glass. My dad used to say, what's remembered lives. I maybe spent too much of my life just remembering.
One of the things I love most about this life is that there's no final goodbye. I've met hundreds of people out here, and I don't ever say a final goodbye. Let's just say, I'll see you down the road. And I do. I see them again. And I can be certain in my heart, I'll see you again.
So that was a clip from Nomadland. So David, one massive thing straight up front is we have an Oscar winner in a protagonist role here. Frances McDormand. She's not a local rodeo rider that Chloe Zhao has picked out of obscurity. What difference does that make?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting one. I mean, yeah, like this, obviously this is the sort of the big mix up from the big kind of difference between this and her previous films. I mean, like, it's I would say when I first saw the film, like, maybe it's a case of my own instincts or my own curiosity not being up to scratch, but like it wasn't something that kind of necessarily registered with me, or you know, I didn't sort of like feel that there was this kind of discrepancy, or there was this kind of chasm between here are these people and here are these people. I mean, I mean, the choice is, you know, I think it's been a fairly, I mean, I think people like to sort of discuss these things and people have opinions about them, and some people think it's a good idea, some people don't think it's a good idea, and everyone has their reasons. And I think that for me, that this idea of like having the big Hollywood star, you know, basically doing what Chloe Zhao does in the making of her films, which is embedding into these communities. You know, she, you know, Frances McDormand is basically doing the research as she is doing the role. It kind of like goes back to like, it's a tradition that kind of goes back to cinema's earliest days. I mean, like, you know, so I think that there was a mix of like stars and real people in like, you know, even in your kind of Soviet silent films. And I mean, you know, you had big stuff like even like Italian neorealism, which this feels like it kind of is maybe more of a sort of pointed hark back to, maybe more so than the Westerns. This feels like a kind of neorealist film. But that, yeah, again, that was a very much a case of like using the kind of the apparatus, the iconography, the star power of film, of cinema, and melding it with reality and with the downtrodden, with you know, dealing with class, dealing with class discrepancy. You know, it's almost like kind of like Trojan horse aspect of, you know, we're going in and we're going to bring this story out with us, kind of thing. I guess that's my take on it.
That's a very even-handed historical bird's eye view kind of look at it. But that has been a debate around the ethics of this film, not least having a lead protagonist embedded in the communities, unlike the previous two, where it was very much rising out of the communities, and also some other aspects of the film as well. Leila, what's your take on all this? Is this what you were alluding to literally minutes ago?
So I was doing a bit of a deep dive into the kind of source material of this. So 2014, a journalist called Jessica Bruder writes this piece that's all about, and it's just after the recession that came out of Bush, but during the Obama years, all about this kind of generation of people that simply don't have the money to retire. And it's these kind of like white working class who are going to have to continue working on until their 80s. And the main subject of that article is Linda May, who's one of the big people in this film, who is she's just wonderful. I mean, like, she should have been an actress her entire life, but she's kind of worked in factories and as a cocktail waitress, and she gets to retirement age and she kind of, her social security is about $500 a month, which you can't live on. And then after the success of that article, Jessica Bruder wrote a book which came out in 2017 called Nomadland, which is, she spent 3 years living with them and living with the people that we see in these films. So living with Swanky, living with Bob Wells, living with Linda May. And Linda May is really actually the central figure in that film. So to me, there are certain issues that I have with the adaptation, having read the book. But like Fern as Frances McDormand kind of makes sense, because she's almost fulfilling that Jessica Bruder like semi-outsider role of like, she's there and she's living it, but more so than the other people, she sort of has a choice. And I think like the film likes to reiterate a few times to us that like Fern does have like choices that have led her to this, and she does have other options available to her and safety nets and stuff, which, you know, none of the rest of them do. But I mean, I really love this film and I think it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking, and I'm very glad that Chloe Zhao is the first woman of color to be nominated for an Oscar. But reading the source material, my issue was that Amazon in the book versus Amazon in the film is a really stark difference. And like the way that they describe it in the book is like truly like horrifying, that these very elderly people getting like horrific injuries, having to be walk 20 miles a day for, you know, getting paid somewhere between $8 and $11 an hour. And I just really felt that in the book, it's like fundamentally a story of poverty. And this film is using this kind of mechanisms of that poverty to make a film about grief, which is fine. But I sort of wish that there hadn't been a sort of betrayal of like the Amazon experience, because like in retrospect that feels a little bit weird to me, that like, oh okay, we're going to use these people's story, but then we're also going to kind of like sugarcoat one of the systems that is like taking advantage of them, if that makes sense.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because whether you see it as a positive or negative, I think Nomadland and that topic in particular brings into sharp relief some of the things we've talked about already. Like, she is definitely a social realist filmmaker in the sense of she's respectful of these communities, wants to embed herself and be sensitive and portray them. But the political aspect is often buried a couple of layers below, and often by the end of a film, that's where a character study narrative plot element often overshadows any greater points.
And I do understand, like, as an artist, that you do kind of want to maybe depoliticize something like that a bit, because you're fundamentally making a story about Fern and not about kind of the economic failures of the Obama administration. But I wouldn't say it's a betrayal, because that's a bit harsh, but it does feel a little bit tricky to kind of reconcile those things.
And it can be very easy to watch a film like this. I realise we're going quite deep on the political aspects. I think we can pull out of this slipstream in a second. But it's very easy to watch this film. Admittedly, you do mention Linda May, who is very much that itinerant worker going between factories and seasonal work. And that's the life that Fern is living, Frances McDormand along for the ride as Fern. But there are other characters like Swanky or Bob Wells, who's this sort of nomad guru with a YouTube channel that we see in these kind of beautiful sequences where they're all sharing their experiences. Some of them are definitely not working class. Some of them worked in the city, worked in finance. They had a boat, you know, then this is what they decided to do with their retirement instead. Mm. It can almost take on a sort of classless quality, become for me almost like this poetic evocation of this is the last gasp of a post-hippie generation. It almost see this, some of the scenes in this could almost be like 50 years on from Easy Rider, out in the sticks trying to forge a new community and society outside of the American mainstream. So you can almost, this can end up being almost like an apolitical movie in that way, which when you see a big wide establishing shot of an Amazon factory with, I think the line is being, Amazon are okay, as a description.
And the money is great. Money. That's the word that really, like, God.
It has rattled people. But that is only like one aspect of this film.
Sure.
So, David, can bring us up to other aspects that are going at play here that may be a bit different from the political aspects.
Right. Oh, I wanted to talk about the political aspects.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No. I think it's a really interesting case study almost, because I agree with you and I don't agree with you. I think a lot of people have said that it is depoliticized. It has the kind of political element muffled. People are asking questions like, why are there no, like, you know, rabbit, you know, why is this not showing, you know, depicting the rise of Trump? Why is this not showing, you know, this aspect or that aspect, and very much kind of like, why isn't this the film that I want it to be, you know, like and I think that, like, there is that trap of, like, you know, we have to, whether we agree with it or don't agree with it, we have to, like, look at the film that has been made. The more I read about the, initially I think with the Amazon stuff I was kind of like, oh, it's, you know, it's just a kind of, you know, almost a sort kind of vignette, and you don't necessarily, you're not there long enough to see anything too bad. And actually, it's not like, you wouldn't describe it as, like, you know, the maybe the sort of political jabs that she does make are ones where she is kind of, you know, there's a sort of subtlety to them, you know, like there's a long pan across, like, you know, rows and rows and rows of, like, these kind of processing stations that are just kind of never ending. And you know, like the everything is very, very kind of like, there is a kind of, yeah, as you say, it's like post-apocalyptic. It's kind of like huge, big, air, you know, unfriendly, soulless airport hangar style digs, and, like, you know, it's very, very kind of it's dehumanizing, but she's not necessarily, like, pushing that stuff in front of you. And, like, I haven't read the book, so I do understand, you know, I've read a lot of articles being written about, like, you know, it's maybe a bad time for the film because Amazon's kind of personnel and HR are coming under such like hot scrutiny at the moment, you know, them not allowing people to like, you know, use the bathroom. And it, you know, it's very, you know, it looks less good for Nomadland to suddenly have this kind of like, you know, let's say ambiguous sex segment of a trip into Amazon, or two trips into Amazon, I guess. And then, but yeah, no, it's, I just find that it's not, you know, I appreciate the fact that it's not didactic, and that it's not just, it's not kind of just basically kind of rehashing the headlines, trying to be, trying to sort of be relevant to a very specific moment, and trying to actually be a bit more kind of timeless and talk about these kind of bigger themes, and like, you know, these are just the choices of like what we see. The, you know, these are the moments that make it into the film, and you know, I think that like those choices actually make the political aspect of the, I mean, it's almost like they're there for you to see, but the dots haven't been joined. Like you can make assumptions on the material. You can look at how things might have led to other things, or how characters might, you know, how their path might end up. Bob Wells might end up being like rampant Trump like nut job, you know, like, but
how dare you.
I don't, you know, I don't believe he is, but still, I mean, you know, you kind of like, it's interesting that it has, you know, it's empathizing with everyone, you know, like it's trying to sort of say that everyone is worthy of empathy, and I think just by suddenly having some like offhand the thing, or some sort of political reference, you change the chemistry of the film, you know, you make it into something else, you make it into a partisan thing, you make it into a critique, and it's just like, I just don't think that's what she wanted to do, you know, like that's and you know, that I'm not saying that that's necessarily like a good or bad thing, I'm just saying that like I think I appreciate it for taking the road less traveled in term, you know, no pun intended, or in terms of like of trying to actually muffle the kind of screaming in your face, you know, this is what I believe, you know.
Is that you hinting at hillbilly elegy?
That's really interesting you bring that up, because that, you know, that's the exact, you know, that is, I think that they are worthy of comparison, because like, but because hillbilly elegy does everything wrong that I think Nomadland does right.
Yeah.
And in that it is trying to it's taking the temperature of a community. It is trying to work out how these people did this thing, or, you know, looking at behavior, looking at social makeup, and this, and it's so clunky, and it's so like, you know, eye rolly, and so wrong headed. And you watch this, and it's like, you don't have to kind of force that stuff. You know, you don't have to drag it out. It can just be there if you let it, you know.
What I'd like to see is a sort of hacky Funny or Die sketch, which is, you know, how they would do What If Wes Anderson Did a Superhero Movie. Mm. I'd like to see Chloe Zhao's Sorry We Missed You, which is sort of, you know, what you're saying there is like, you know, it's the antithesis of a Ken Loach shouting in your face. And he just did that with, you know, the gig economy and delivery drivers and the horrible situation they're in. He does not believe that everyone deserves empathy. I'd love to see what the spoof version of that.
Last little thing, I would say that I'm really fascinated by what Layla said about, you know, how this question of, is she parlaying or trying to sort of dampen certain aspects to be able to tell a film, you know, to make a film about grief. And you know, that for me is like, that's a fascinating question. And I think at the end of the day, I think that the film raises loads of really fascinating ethical questions, which I don't think necessarily have like finite answers, but that are going to turn some people on, are going to turn some people off. But like, I think it just throws up so much interesting, like it just throws up so many questions. And I think that for me, is a kind of inherently makes it a good film. If you're questioning how a film has been made and the choices that a director has made, that can only ever be a good thing.
And so many of her, I mean, so much of all three of these films come down to grief and mourning. Like, that seems to be like a big theme that she keeps referring to. And like in each one of these films, there's a sort of like, there's something lost that someone, that the characters are dealing with. And yeah, but I just think, like, I mean, I really would suggest reading the book. And even if you can't manage the book, like the article by Jessica Bruder is still up. That it is like, it really does feel like a marriage made in heaven with these styles, because as much as Chloe Zhao makes these films that feel like documentaries, Jessica Bruder has written a book that feels like a novel. Like, she gets so kind of close and ingrained in her subjects that it does feel that she must be writing about kind of people that she's invented. And you kind of get to have another layer of Bob Wells and Linda May and Swanky, who is my favorite. Like, and they're fascinating, wonderful people. And it's really nice that they're kind of getting a moment in the sun, because they've really been quite like forgotten by their wider society and community.
It sounds like that is what I should go away and do, is read the Nomadland book. Because for me, there's a tension between what I see as three competing projects here, which is the poetic level of the visual poetry, as we've discussed in the previous films, is here in full effect. So much of these shots of lone figures across landscapes that are both beautiful and forbidding. But then also what could be pitched as Francis's road trip across America, where you're watching sequences where it is almost documentary sequences of Frances McDormand as Fern, but the Fern character in this, you know, the balance between the two is unclear. Where I'd love to watch Frances McDormand just hanging out with people. The fact entertainment pitch based off the back of this, I think, could be quite strong. And then this romantic drama that kicks in. And there's nothing that signals that more than after watching Frances McDormand with non-actors for a chunk of time, you then see David Strathairn, Oscar nominee David Strathairn, wander onto screen. And you're like, oh, here's our other character for the rest of the film, or for another chunk of the film. And I'm being very cynical there. Mm-hmm. But on second view, it's the tension between those three bits where I think the documentary aspect, the visual poetry aspect are just off the charts for me. Beautiful.
Yeah. I'm glad I read the book second, I must say. I think it would have been quite hard to come to it if I had like formed ideas of who these people were in my head.
But I wonder, David, you said that it's the plotting aspect of some of her earlier films that is where you fell down. Is that resolved here when it becomes this character study, this relationship study in the back half, back third maybe?
Yeah, I definitely didn't feel like it definitely for me felt more organic in this one. This for me is like, for, I felt it was like the most fully formed of her films and that avoided that kind of I thought the end, it kept a similar momentum throughout the film. I thought she has these little kind of stop offs at her, you know, she goes and visits her sister, and then she goes to sort of David Strathairn's son's house for a little stay, and she has that kind of the dilemma aspect of whether she should settle down and, you know, move on is it happens earlier in the film, so it's not been used as this kind of like climactic thing. Mm-hmm. And then you have this kind of almost sort of like very mournful coda where she returns to this sort of old mining town. Again, it's like, you know, mourning the death of tradition and you know, it's interesting, because I think that the whole idea of like mining, and the fact that the intimation being that her kind of late husband died from some kind of industrial disease at this mining plant. I think it's cancer, but I guess that, you know, that would maybe a product of working in such environments. Yeah. It's a kind of subtle critique of these kind of boom towns that kind of easy come, easy go, and the human flotsam that kind of rush in and rush out as they come and go. Her whole life of being dictated to by the kind of growth of industry and jobs and where, you know, where she can kind of settle down. But no, yeah, sorry to ask, I'm rambling, but to answer your question, yeah, I definitely didn't feel like, yeah, I feel that the momentum of the film was, it was more, more constant in this. And it, I think that the one thing I would have loved if it would have ended a tiny bit further, like a tiny bit. Actually, I don't really want to, let's not talk about the ending, but I think the only gripe I had was basically, like, and people could maybe like see this when they see the film, I wish it had ended one shot earlier. That's all I'll say.
Oh. So we could go at length about Nomadland. It is such a rich film to talk about, but I think we should put some scores on this just so we can bring this conversation to a close. So David, I'll come to you first for your scores for this.
Okay, I saw it just around the Venice time, and yeah, I straight up loved it. I think my anticipation was maybe a little cooler. Maybe it was probably like a 4, but then maybe a 4.5 because, you know, because Frances McDormand was in it, and you know, I do love Frances McDormand. And then, yeah, probably like 5.5s. I mean, it like just was, you know, really affecting film, hit similar notes on a second viewing. I think some unlocked some of the richness. And I even think that, like, as I mentioned before, you know, I think sometimes, you know, when you kind of dig into a film, and it happened with Three Billboards as well, which is obviously a more hot button controversial film, and that maybe a film that I have, you know, my take has differed on having seen it again, but maybe we can go into that. That's a whole other conversation.
Oh, I will do a whole podcast on that.
but it's interesting how yeah, that these debates form around these Frances McDormand Oscar vehicles. And I don't necessarily think this one is as contentious as Three Billboards, but it's still very kind of important and a really fascinating topic. So yeah, that's me.
What were your scores?
Oh, 4.55.
Right, Layla.
So I would say I saw it at LFF, and it had a lot of positive buzz already by that point. So I was probably at a 4. Because I'd been gaslit into thinking that Three Billboards was going to be good, and I fully hated that. So a slightly cautious 4, despite all of the really good buzz. And then when I was watching it, I was just completely on board with this sort of like lyrical, slow burn tragedy of it all in the atmosphere. And like, it was really nice for me to see kind of Frances McDormand being so kind of subtle and natural. And we were discussing a completely different film earlier, but you know, the difficulty of actually just performing by yourself, as she is for much of this film, and not kind of going into melodrama, I really loved it. But then I did probably come back down to a 4 again, having read the book, because just certain aspects kind of sit a little uneasy with me. But I'm very happy for all of Chloe Zhao's success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can get behind that sentiment too. This was one of the only two films I saw in the last 12 months in the cinema. So I saw this and Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder.
Nice.
So I was up against some strong competition. But seeing Nomadland, almost the act of seeing it was more dazzling for me, being in the cinema all masked up in October after 6 months away, more than the film. But then it was rewatching it recently that clarified my feelings on it. And I do have this tension between all these competing parts that mean it's maybe something like a 4 in anticipation, maybe 3 enjoyment, 4 in retrospect. I really do enjoy wrestling with these aspects, and it's been such fun talking with you two today about it. If I'm allowed a parting shot, I don't like Ludovico Einaudi's score. I think especially after the previous two films where there wasn't much of an intrusive score, lots of diegetic music of the communities she was moving through. Ludovico Einaudi, I'm quite a fan of this sort of recent piano-based neoclassical movement, the Max Richters, Johan Johansson's, Oliver Arnold's of the world. However, Ludovico Einaudi is a little bit too close to the sort of pure moods, piano moods CD you'd get in a petrol station in 1993 for my taste.
Oof.
Anyway, and I'm probably going to lose some friends over that because I know that the score had some lovers out there. But listeners, that was Nomadland, one of the most talked about films of the year. And now that it's going out on Disney Plus, I'm sure it'll be talked about some more. Let us know what you think of the usual channels at LW Lies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. David, should we shout out the Chloe Zhao Nomadland zine that the White Lies have put out?
Yes, we absolutely can do that. We in January this year we made a little we were fans of Nomadland, and just because it was kind of moving around the schedule so much, we didn't really get a chance to kind of give it its dues in the print magazine. So we ended up making a little zine version of it, which you can, if anyone wants to see, we can you can maybe follow us on Twitter or send us a DM, and we can see if we've got any spare copies knocking around. One way you can get hold of a copy is by joining our exclusive membership scheme, which you can get through on our website, and you'll be sent a zine through with that. So, you know, there are ways, but it's a lovely, you know, I think Layla's seen it and can attest to
it. I have
seen
it, and I was not asked to contribute to it, but that's fine. I will say that, like, the illustration for it is absolutely wonderful, and it's got pride of place in my living room at the moment. My son, weirdly, is completely fascinated by it. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Terrific. So that's the Little White Lies Nomadland tie-in zine. Check it out if you'd like to. So that pretty much wraps up our Zhao Pod special. David, Layla, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you for bringing your insights and wisdom to our chat. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. I'm Michael Leader, and we'll be back with another episode of Truth and Movies very soon.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.